You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Old Lady Speaks podcast on Black and White and Red All Over. I am your host, Danny, coming to you for episode number 75. And how fitting that we are on a nice sounding number. And what we are about to talk about is not very nice at all. So, as always, if you want to listen to us on your favorite podcasting platform, feel free to search Black and White and Red All Over, whether it is on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or on Spotify. Hit subscribe and like. Leave us a review and a rating if possible. And now to the happy stuff. We've got Sam Lopresti. Hello, Sam.
Happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, yes. Joy, joy.
So are you Ren or are you Stimpy?
Yes.
Yes, exactly. No Chucks this week because he is being a good fiancé. So we've got Sergio Romero. Hello, Sergio.
Hey, fellas. Happy to be here, as always. Happy in general to do the podcast. Not happy about how the whole situation is going. But, you know. It's going to be a solid group therapy, I'm guessing.
Yes, indeed. Speaking of the quote-unquote situation, Sergio, what's your takeaway from the week?
Diving right into it, I'm going to be short. I think Juventus is not a good team. They're not a good football team. They're just not. And, you know, they have the name. They have the brand recognition. They have the players with big sounding names. But, you know, when it comes to it, they're just not a good football team. And this week showed how far they are from really, really competing, especially when faced against their direct competition domestically and someone who, and a team that is going to be contending for the Champions League. They just couldn't match up. They're not a good football team. I don't know if that's just right now, if they're not a good football team right now, or just as a whole and for the remainder of the season, they're going to continue to be a bad team, but that's just the facts. And I think that's my biggest takeaway of the week.
What about you, Samuel?
My unfortunate takeaway is a corollary of Sergio's, which is, I don't think we're going to be a good soccer team for a long time yet, because I don't see us getting out of this quickly. I mean, I said this in my recap. I don't think Juventus makes the Champions League next year. Juventus doesn't make the Champions League next year. That is a lot of money that they're not making. That is a lot of players that are probably going to be headed out of here. And we're going to have to be building from the ground up. We're kind of looking at the Jean-Claude Blanc years, because I don't see a quick way out of this without making the Champions League next year. And I don't think we are.
Yeah, I think for me, this week was definitely, and I remember there was a point last season, I think it was about two-thirds of the way through, or maybe three-quarters of the way, essentially when the Pirlo era went from they're sitting around third place, they're still within striking distance of the two Milan sides, and then it just caved in and went downhill in a hurry. And it's obviously something that I'm sure a good portion of the listenership here has, and also the people on the blog as readers, have been recounting as we've been going through the episodes of All or Nothing on Amazon Prime over the last few days. And this is kind of the week where it's like, man, this shows you just how far this team has to go to not only be competitive for a consistent amount of time. And, you know, obviously we're just not very long removed from a unbeaten run that, where they look somewhat decent for a good portion of the time, but it just, yeah, it's that moment where you're like, oh boy, this is, we better get comfortable, because this is not going to be a good ride, and it's not going to end pretty. And I mean, as much as last season was really a literal last minute battle to get into the Champions League, you know, there's still a over half of a season to go, but I don't know. I'm kind of at a loss for words, and I mean, I've struggled with writing about this team the last few games just because I don't know where to go with it. And that's because the week started, and obviously we're in a much different mood than we were 7 days ago. It started with just an absolute kicking, as I marked down my first note for editing, on the hands of the reigning Champions League winners in Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, where not only was Max Allegri's starting lineup questionable, to maybe put it kindly, but just anything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. And yeah, I don't know who wants to go after me rambling, or whatever you want to call this takeaway and part transition segment of mine, but the match against Chelsea was definitely a crash back down to reality, which I guess a lot of us needed, because I was a whole lot more optimistic this time around than last time around against Chelsea. And boy, was I wrong.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking that a win was really in the cards, but I thought we could go in there and get a draw, either a 0-0 or something low scoring. But it, you know, it comes down to really the thing that is so problematic about this team is in the attack. And you know, the fact that Juve barely got anything going from an attacking standpoint against Chelsea. They barely got anything going from an attacking standpoint against Atalanta. I know that's skipping ahead, but, you know, that was a team that had just gotten blitzed in the midweek by Young Boys. I mean, we played Young Boys in recent memory. We know that they are not exactly a quality side, at least at that level. And here we are with two shots on goal that entire game. And I don't know how many shots on goal we had against Chelsea, but it was a very small number, you know. And as soon as you say Juventus isn't scoring goals, everybody brings up the Cristiano Ronaldo sized gorilla in the room. But it's not even, to me, it's not a question of not being able to finish. It's a question of not being able to create the chances in the first place. And you know, and Allegri after the Atalanta game was talking a lot about how that, you know, players are too anxious, the finishing needs to get better. But it's not just that. I could count the number of times where I really thought Juventus was going to score from open play this entire week on one hand. And if you're going up against the elite of your competitions, whether it be European or domestically, and you can't score goals, your margin for error is nil. And as soon as that margin got breached, that was it for, especially against Chelsea in the Chelsea game. As soon as we scored, I knew that the result was gone, because I didn't think we had a goal in us, partly because of the way the team was set up, which was 100%, you know, Allegri was basically could have just been waving a flag in the technical area saying play for 0-0. And that based on that lineup. And this isn't a team that can generate that kind of offense against the teams that it on whose levels they want to be. And yes, Chelsea is one of the elite defensive teams in Europe right now, at the level of peak BBC for us when, you know, in the middle of last decade. But, you know, you want to see the goalkeeper troubled a few times. The only time I ever thought we were going to score in the Chelsea game was when Morata had the tip that Thiago Silva somehow ran down. So yeah, just this attack doesn't work. You know, a lot of it has to do with the midfield, because as good as Manuel Locatelli is, he can't do everything, and no one else in the midfield is able to really create. McKennie can kind of be a final link coming up through the channel, but he's not a creative guy. And, you know, here we are spinning our wheels. You know, I don't remember the last time we scored. Lazio was a 2-0 win. Remind me the last time we scored more than one goal before that. I think it was when we beat Sampdoria at the end of September.
In the league, yeah. Because, I mean, the
right,
only.
Right, yeah, there was Malmo.
There's also Zenit, right?
And Zenit. Vertura, yeah. But that almost makes it worse, because it's not even the European competition you're doing with. It's domestic, and it's against teams that aren't that good. I mean, you know, Fiorentina, you know, they've had a good spell this year with Vincenzo Italiano, but he is not that, you know, they are not the kind of team that we should be banking on a stoppage time winner against. You know, I don't think this Roma team is as good as a 1-0 win for us. There's nothing in this attack, and it doesn't look like there's anything that these players can do, at least under what Allegri is telling them, to fix it.
I thought that the biggest difference between the first game against Chelsea in Italy and the game against Chelsea in England was that, you know, I think the core idea or the core thought about how to get the result was the same, which was, let's defend, let's park the bus and hope for some luck. But it was very different in the way they approach it. I thought that in Italy, it was gimmicky, sure, and it was forced because they were without a lot of players and with some injuries, but they didn't really have a point of a target man, a point of attack, really, with Federico Bernardeschi, with Chiesa. They didn't really have a straight-up striker, but they had a lot of players that could provide an outlet, that could kind of, you know, if you had a chance on the counter, they could attack, they could dribble and attack and get that counterattack started. And I thought that's exactly what they missed in England, because, you know, we've seen Allegri do this. He did it against Chelsea in the first game. He did it against Lazio just a week ago. It feels like a longer than a week ago, but it was just a week ago, that he's just going to concede the possession and be like, okay, you can have the ball because our midfield is going to get overrun. That's fine. But we're not really going to let you do anything with it. And he tried to do the same thing against Chelsea, but that's not going to work against that side twice. And that's definitely not going to work with the way that he tried to approach it in England, which was a straight up, you know, with a target man in Alvaro Morata, with like a full midfield. It just wasn't going to work. It was a different approach. I thought the strikerless approach in Italy worked great because the defense was a little bit confused. They didn't really know who to cover, and everyone could come out and start a counter. That just didn't happen in England. They just got completely bodied from the moment the game started. They just couldn't hold the ball. They just couldn't really do anything. And look, listen, losing against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, that's not horrible. I mean, like Sam was saying, that's a truly elite level club in Europe. If you lose against them away, that's fine. I mean, that's a lot of teams would lose to them against away, but it just was the way they lost. They had no shot, absolutely no shot. They looked absolutely outclassed. And as someone who has rooted for a losing team in my domestic league in Mexico, I know what that looks like. I know exactly what that looks like when it's like, okay, we're like in a different class, in a different level. There's really no shot for us here. And that's pretty much the way Chelsea handled Juventus for 90 minutes. It was just a complete slaughter. I mean, they just had no chance from the get-go. And, you know, I said it in the first segment about our biggest takeaway is just that this team just cannot compete against those clubs in a consistent basis. Are we going to get lucky here and there? Are we going to come up with some tactics? I think Allegri is capable of coming up with a, you know, cute, weird tactic in which Federico Bernardeschi is the freaking second striker and, you know, he kind of flummoxes a team and he gets a win. He's absolutely still capable of doing that, but you're just going to, you know, gimmicks are only going to take you so far. And when it's a straight up one-on-one matchup without any gimmicks, without, you know, your best players against our best players, we just really can't compete. And I think Allegri does deserve a certain amount of blame, because I do think a lot of the decisions he made were kind of questionable. And I think they made an already bad situation worse. But at its core, you know, the biggest point is that we're just not good enough to compete right now for Europe. And that was the goal for so long that it just kind of got ingrained for Juventus fans the last decade. Like, oh, that has to be our goal. And I think at this point that's just so out of reach that it really, it should be, you know, in the back burner. We should be hoping for a positive, for a decent round of 16 opponent, hope that we can get into a quarterfinals. And that's about it, because at this point, this team is just not good enough. And could the coach make some changes and maybe give the team a better shot? Absolutely. But I really don't think there's a coach alive that could come in and mold this team or do something with this team that is going to put them at the level of the Chelseas, of the Bayern Munich, of the Liverpools, of the really top, top teams. That there's absolutely nothing that we can do. And that's a rather harsh reality to stomach. But I think that's where this team is. And like Danny was saying earlier.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
I don't think that's going to change quickly.
So, Sam, I did the math while Sergio was talking. In 19 games in all competitions, Juventus has scored more than one goal. So they've scored two goals or more 7 times. So a little more than a third of their games, which not great. Secondly, since we are on the topic of the Champions League, and since Sergio just brought up hopefully getting a decent draw, here are the current group leaders. And obviously some things can happen on the last match day where a few groups could change and, you know, who finishes first. Some teams can flip-flop, essentially, is what I'm getting at here. Is Group A, Manchester City. Group B, Liverpool. Obviously, Juventus won't be playing Chelsea if things hold there. Group D, Real Madrid. Group C, Ajax. Group G, Lille. Group F, United, which would be hilarious for Juventus to get them. Group E, Bayern Munich, which brings terror to my thoughts. And, yeah. That is outside of maybe Lille and a United team that is very much kind of in the same situation as Juventus right now, although without an actual manager. That's about as big name pot as you can get, isn't it, folks?
Yeah, and it's hilarious because we've been, you know, how many times have I talked about how the winning the group isn't that big of a deal anymore because of the way that the group stages.
Take that, Lopresti.
Yeah. This year is a little bit of a, and you know, for the most part that's been true, but this year is definitely an aberration in that regard because this is a huge lineup of teams. Imagine that Chelsea magically goes to sleep in Russia and we beat Malmo and we win the group. Then we're looking potentially at PSG. Porto again would be hilarious. Either Borussia Dortmund or Sporting. That would be doable because the two of them are, you know, Sporting isn't exactly flying and Borussia Dortmund's really in a bad spot right now. We wouldn't get anybody in Group D because that would be Inter, unless Inter pass Real at the last second. And then, I mean, I wouldn't mind playing Barcelona if we won the group. And then you'd have either Villarreal or nobody from Group F because we wouldn't be getting an Italian team, you know, Red Bull Salzburg in Group G. That, you know, it's not like the group winning is much better, but it was of paramount importance to win this group more so than it has been since the seeding rules for the group stage draw have changed. And that's
it's a lot more manageable. It's a lot more manageable. I mean, I've always, that's a take that you and Chucks, or dearly departed Chucks, was not here.
Dearly departed.
Yeah, may that sounded rest, like he died.
May
or
he
something.
Rest in peace.
Yeah,
no. I was going to say
the sign of the cross, and we shall remember Chucks on next week's episode.
I'm like a dog. If I don't see him, he's like gone forever for me. But you know, that's a take that you and Chucks have had for a while. That, you know, that being first in the group like doesn't really matter that much. And that's a take that I've always opposed because it absolutely matters. Like if you check, absolutely, there's good teams always in first group or second group, you can always get a team that that's good or bad. But I do think that consistently going, like finishing first, has given you better odds in general. There's always tough teams, but it has given you better odds in general. And we have seen that the last couple of years. I mean, we drew both Lyon and Porto by finishing first, which in paper were very favorable draws. Obviously, they face planted because they are a terrible team. But we're talking right now on paper. And on paper, they were very favorable draws. And you see it again right now, right? Like when you go down the list, when if Juventus finish first, you have a lot of teams that you feel okay with playing. And when if they finish second, which they most likely will, you really look at that murderer's row of teams. And it's like, I don't think we're favored against any of them. Like not one of those clubs, I think Juventus would be favored. Maybe Ajax. Maybe, and that's a massive maybe. Like outside of that, I don't think they're going to be favored against any single one of those clubs. And let alone favored, I don't think they're going to have a shot against any of those teams. Like if they go against Bayern Munich, if they go against Liverpool, if they go against one of those teams, like I don't see a scenario in which we beat them. Like I really, really don't. I think those teams are just leaps and bounds better than Juventus right now. So
The team bus crashes is pretty much the only way that we,
there's no way. I mean, I really can't see a scenario in which, for example, if they draw Bayern Munich, I'd be happy if they just don't get blown out. Like if they can go out gracefully, that'd be for me the best case scenario if we draw Bayern Munich. And that's the situation you put yourself by finishing in second. You go against the big top dogs. And I know that Chucks has said like, hey, you have to play them eventually if you want to be champions. Well, sure, eventually. Can we make it, you know, later rather than sooner? I mean, I guess that'd be the, you know, if we can face them in the semifinals instead of in the round of 16 and get bounced yet again in round 16, like I'd rather do that. So yeah, I mean, not only was this result deflating because of the way they lost, it's also deflating because it almost, unless you get some really, really good luck, it almost guarantees that you're going to be going against one of the heavy favorites to lift the trophy. And it almost guarantees that you're going to get bounced in the round of 16 again in a situation where you needed to go as deep as possible in order to, you know, be as financially secure as you could possibly be given the circumstances. And they're not going to be able to do that. So it's just this carousel of, you know, mediocrity that continues to perpetuate itself. And it's just, it's hard to envision how they break out of it. And that's, I think, the toughest part of how the Chelsea game went down. It's like, we're bad now, and we will continue to be bad for the foreseeable future. And that's just a bad place to be as a fan base and as a club, but, you know, as a fan base too.
Two things before we transition into the Atalanta talk. You get matched up against a Liverpool or a City or a Bayern, and Allegri goes ultra defensive like he did in London on Tuesday. How much do you think those teams are just licking their lips saying, oh boy, we are going to just tear them apart? Because I mean,
I think they need a mop.
Yeah. I mean, it won't be pretty, especially knowing how, you know, once Chelsea got that ball rolling at Stamford Bridge. I mean, it was like you said, Sam, once that first goal was in, it was, you know, kind of the sinking feeling of, okay, well, we've got to watch the rest of this because the game feels over at this point.
No, it felt like I was just thinking back about the back in the year they made the Berlin final. I remember that they posted a meme where it was like a bunch of lions looking at a zebra, and they put like Juventus and then all the other teams in the semifinals because everyone wanted them. And then when Juventus beat Real Madrid, like the Juventus official account, like reposted all those memes, like, you know, like being like, we made the final. But now I think that meme actually applies. I think everyone's going to be looking at Juventus like, oh yeah, like that they have no shot, especially if it's one of those big teams. I mean, just the way Chelsea scored that third goal was just, I mean, it was just comical. It was like when upperclassmen are playing like the younger kids, and it's just that like they're destroying the, like they're just passing the ball all over. It was just, that's when the game went from like, oh, it's a bad loss, to it's like a sad loss. Like now it's just a bummer to watch this team play.
It was varsity against freshmen, and I am here to fully admit that I totally forget my second point. So we are on to Atalanta, which unfortunately, I mean, it performance-wise, it wasn't the worst in the world, but as we know, so many of these games now domestically, if not all of them, are must-win, and Max Allegri himself has said it. We have said it on the website. We have said it on the podcast. But now Juventus head into Tuesday's game in Salerno, 7 points behind Atalanta, obviously looking like a team that has absolutely no identity whatsoever outside of a squad that is kind of just all over the place. And I don't know. I really, when you're relying on a Paulo Dybala free kick in deep stoppage time to salvage 1 point, that kind of just shows you how things have gone.
Yeah. And it's a little bit of a surprise that it's been this long, considering how good Atalanta's been for the last couple of years and how tough Atalanta has played Juve the last few years. Yes, Atalanta are a good team now. Losing to them even at home is not necessarily out of the question. But for you to lose to Atalanta at home for the first time since I was 2 months old, like, that's another, you talk about the psychological blows, Sergio. That's another one of those. That is the announcement that the Allianz is no longer the ultimate fortress that it was as it started to open. You know, when it took a year and a half for somebody to beat us in there. For a long time, the only team that beat us in Europe in there was Bayern. Like, it was, you know, the year that Bayern had won the whole thing. You know, now Fiorentina's going in there.
And I just find it ironic that it comes on a night where it felt like this crowd was as jacked up as we've seen this entire season, Chelsea match included. And just we saw, so, you know, like you mentioned, that early stretch of after the stadium opened when they were literally unbeatable. And they just fed off that energy, and this team couldn't feed off any of the energy that was in the stadium. And that's what got me excited early on watching, because so much of the last few years have kind of, and obviously a lot of it came with an empty stadium, but so much of the last few years have really, you know, kind of the vibe around the crowds have really not been the same as those early Scudetto years. And now it, you know, this Saturday was like, all right, this kind of feels like an old, you know, really kind of like the crowd rising to the occasion. And well, the team didn't.
Yeah. And even during the Chelsea match, I could hear the away section quite well for a large part of the game on Tuesday as well. It did seem like there was that enthusiasm, but it just, like you said, it was, you know, it just never took. And I think that's a, you know, you could, it's telling that at the end of the game, the only five players went to face the ultras at the Curva Sud at the end of the game, all of whom are guys that have won Scudetti and had been around a long time. You know, the only one that was relatively new to the team was Matthijs de Ligt. Out of those five, everybody else, you know, was off doing, you know, their own, you know, doing their own thing. But it really goes to show you that that invincibility that you had at home is now gone. And it's at a point where you now start going in and wondering whether you might be going down with anybody going in there. I mean, Benevento beat us at home last year. And where are they in Serie B right now? Not actually doing that great. And again, it's, are Atalanta a good team? Yes. Is Giampiero Gasperini an excellent coach? Yes. But it feels like this is a game that you can at least get a point and keep the status quo out of, and you're not. And that's what you were saying before, Sergio, is that period of that mentality is starting to end, and it has to be built back up to. And the question now is, how does that happen? You know, one of the big things when Antonio Conte arrived was, you know, here's Antonio Conte. He's going to bring the Juventus DNA back to Juventus. He's going to bring the Juventinità back to Juventus. And a lot of people were saying the same thing about Allegri when he came back. Are we seeing that? I don't think so. Is that necessarily Allegri's fault? I think it's maybe too early to say. It's certainly Allegri's fault that he's playing outdated tactics, that he still refuses to play players in positions that get the best out of them, that goes for a large part of this game, I think, was that, you know, it just, the lineup wasn't right. I was actually really surprised when Weston McKennie got hurt and Moise Kane went in instead of somebody like Rodrigo Bentancur. That was actually kind of really a shock to me that Allegri just started going for broke in that regard instead of just making a like for like substitution and keeping running. Whether or not this kind of kickstarts him, who knows? I mean, now we're down to calling up guys from the U23s now with Chiesa down. Now that guy happens to be Matthias Sule, who looks really damn good. Look up the goal that he scored on Tuesday in the UEFA Youth League against Chelsea. It was nice. It was tight angle, really good goal. But like you said, Sergio, how does Allegri get out of this? The only saving grace now is that the quality is about to drop of the teams that we're playing is about to drop for the next month. And maybe we can find some sort of equilibrium that'll kind of carry them and start building to be something better than the sum of the parts. But right now, what is there?
Yeah, again, I think a lot of it, and I've always been a bit, I wouldn't say hesitant, but, you know, have a relatively healthy doubt about the whole, oh, they just don't care. They just don't, are not Juve players. They don't care. It's like, as the game globalizes, as the game becomes, you know, what it is right now, I think all of those old myths kind of start losing some of their luster. But I will say, after, you know, getting dropped 4-0, after, you know, really getting, I mean, when you lose a game like that, you expect at the bare least to come out, you know, guns blazing in the next one. And they just didn't. They lacked a certain fire. I don't think it's they don't care. Like, of course they care. They're professional football players. They're hyper-competitive dudes. Obviously they care. But it was such a... Like, if you didn't know any better, you'd think, oh, they're first in the league. They're first in the table. Like, whatever. They really didn't look like a team fighting for their really slim, their very slim sliver of a chance that they still have to be champions. They really didn't look like they were playing like that. You have guys that were, you know, that have been really, really good players from the moment they came to Juventus, like Matthijs de Ligt. Like, he struggled. Like, he struggled badly against Chelsea, and he struggled badly against Atalanta. Like, suddenly you have one of those dudes who you could absolutely put in your team sheet and be sure that he's going to deliver. And even he, right now, he's having bad performances. You have guys like Alexander, who for the longest amount of time, you know, was another guy that you thought, oh, well, at worst, he's going to be average. Like, he's playing way below average right now. You have just a lot of guys that you just don't really trust anymore. You just don't really see good performance from them. And even in this position, when it's like, okay, it's a direct competitor for the quote-unquote title, but most likely like top four finish, and they just come into your stadium and beat you, and you put two shots on target the whole game. It's just... it's frustrating to watch. It's a bummer to watch. I do think that there's something to, like Sam was saying, only five players going out and facing the fans and facing the music. I know that also seems kind of like a, you know, whatever tabloid thing, but it really does say something that right now there's not a lot of leaders in this club. There's not a lot of guys that, because either they just don't have the authority, or they just, you know, whatever you might say, but there's just not, it's not a cohesive team right now, both I think on the field and off the field. I don't think it's a salvageable situation at this point. And I think in any other, you know, situation, in any other scenario, you look at this team and you blow it up. I mean, if this were any other team, any other league, I mean, like in the NFL or the NBA or whatever, like you'd be hearing a bunch of like, hey, we're going to trade everyone for draft picks. Like, because you right now, Juventus is at a point where it's like, okay, we're old, we're overpaid, and we're not good enough. Like, that's just the reality of what this team is right now. And that's a tough, tough, tough spot to be, especially with the economic situation that they have right now. Because like I said, a fire sale or just a sell everyone and rebuild, it's just not going to be something feasible right now. And it's hammering the same point over and over again. Like, they're not good right now. And I don't think they'll be good for a while. You know, Max Allegri or no Max Allegri, it's it's just a bad team, and that will continue. If they can't beat Atalanta, then I agree with Sam. Like, if you can't beat Atalanta at home, then you're not going to be a top four team. Like, that's just going to be a thing. And at this point, I know it's going to be, you know, painful for everyone, because they, in all likelihood, they are going to have to sell off players and really rebuild from the start. But maybe that's what needs to happen. That maybe that's the rebuild they really, really need. Just missing out on Europe altogether, blowing it up and figuring it out on the go with young players. Like Sam was saying, a guy like Matias Süle, who looks really, really talented, giving him more shots, bring in all the guys you have on loans, giving those guys any shots, and see if you can start building the next great Juve team. Because right now, it doesn't look great. It really, really doesn't. And we could be talking about, hey, if that Paulo Dybala free kick curls a little bit lower, then we're talking about something else. Or if Federico Chiesa, you know, manages to take a shot counterattack, you know, sure, they could have won that game even. But it's not, you know, we've been saying that for three coaches now. If this had gone the other way, if this had gone the other way, if just this one little thing, if they hadn't made this mistake. And at some point, it's like, well, if it's always a little something little that you didn't do, perhaps it's who you are. Perhaps it's just a bad team that is going to continue to be bad. And that is just who we are at this point.
I know I've been hitting the youth sector with a stick for years, but I was saving this for our next topic, but you gave me a good opportunity to bring it up now. Chelsea played five players on Tuesday that were straight out of their academy against us. Three in the starting lineup, two more came on as subs. Two of them scored. It is not sustainable to just have absolutely no production out of your youth sector for the first team, because eventually stuff like this will happen and you're not going to have anything to fall back on.
And look at why they had to go to the youth too.
Yeah, exactly. Because they had the transfer ban.
They had the transfer ban. Yeah. Exactly. Like, I think that, you know, just bringing that back to Juventus, I think what would have to happen for Juventus is exactly that: missing out on Europe, going either to Europa League or Conference League or whatever it is that is the second, third tier.
You want the Conference League so bad, Sergio.
I really, really want the Conference League. I want the Conference League so bad. And it's like something like that has to happen, because it has to become untenable to continue on this path. And for some people, for some fans, it has been untenable for a while now. But, you know, it's like a bad gambler who's already down, and it's the only way they can, you know, get back out of that hole is to keep gambling. Like, Juventus feels like they're stuck in that. It's like, we already have way too much invested into this team, so we're going to keep doubling down and doubling down, when what they need is just to full on, you know, tear it down, rebuild, start back up. Is it going to be rough as a fan to watch the team, you know, miss out on Europe, miss out on big transfer targets, play with a bunch of young guys, maybe selling a lot of the guys you have right now? Absolutely. But unless something dramatically changes, I fear that we're just going to be continued on this, you know, sort of overpaid players, sort of bad players. And not to go into the worst case scenario, but that's kind of how Arsenal started. So you never want to get into a situation when you're looking at Arsenal as, you know, your probable future. So it really, Juventus has to figure it out, and figure it out quick.
Arsenal are like that with 10 times the budget that we have. Like, Arsenal was spending like 60 or 70 million euros this year on a defender from Brighton and Hove that I'd never heard of before. And then you look at what we're going to have. And I hate to bring this up, but is Italy going to have to dial back on stadium capacity again and cut into that revenue even more? Because the you know, there are some troubling COVID numbers in Europe right now. The World Health Organization kind of considers it like the hotbed of the pandemic right now, especially Central Europe, which, you know, is not that far from the Italian border. You know, the financial situation is really dire, and it's going to take a while. It's going to take a certain amount it's going to take a particular type of mind to get out of it. Unfortunately, the guy that got us out of it the last time is running Inter now. So that change has to come from the very, very top. And maybe there's an opportunity for that too.
Well, since you mentioned...
I handed you that one, Danny.
I know. I was about to say, since you've mentioned transfers.
Yes, Sam, indeed.
we will transition into our final topic of the day. And since there is so much going on, I think it's safe to assume that Twitter questions will be returning next week. Obviously, before the Atalanta game, there was the news that Juventus are being investigated by Italian authorities for some false accounting, I think is how they properly described it. And basically, the Cliff Notes version is that Juventus are being investigated, and I believe it's other Serie A clubs. So if Sam, since you're on video, if you want to nod and say that, yes, I am correct, feel free to nod and say yes. Okay. I get the thumbs up, so I'm good. So my mind hasn't completely gone to crap during this Juventus week. But Juventus are being investigated by the Italian financial authorities for obviously their multitude of swap deals and the capital gains deals that we have spent many a minutes on this podcast and many a words talking about on the blog over the last few years. And I think it's safe to say the Artur Miram Pjanic swap deal in the summer of 2020 is kind of the headliner of it. And I believe the total is they're looking into 42 plus Valenza deals from 2018 to this past summer between Juventus and other Italian and European clubs. So obviously when you are being investigated by any branch of the Italian government, that is never a good thing. I've seen some people try and downplay this. I've seen other people say, like myself, take this a little more seriously and think about the ramifications to come out of it. So I don't know. It's, we very much know that Juventus has tried to get creative over the last few years because of both the pandemic and everything they've had to do to try and make up for the loss in income when stadiums were empty and everything. So it's very concerning from my point of view. And obviously we don't know how serious these charges are or if there are charges to come up just yet. But if you are, like I said, if you are being investigated by the Italian government for just the simple amount of deals that Juventus are at right now, and I believe the club issued a statement saying they are fully cooperating. There's been reports that Federico Cherubini has been cooperating with them. And essentially, I think it was like he talked with investigators for like 8-9 hours this weekend.
Yeah, that's an interrogation.
That's an interrogation. Yeah. And I believe he was essentially in there. I think the headline from Gazzetta was essentially to explain the ways of Paratici, which, you know, basically say why he was doing these kind of deals he was doing, since Cherubini was the right-hand man to Juve's old chief football officer, who's now at Spurs. So I don't know. It's concerning for me. And I know some, like I said, some people are downplaying it, but this seems like it could become a big deal.
Yeah. I have a lot of people I know are downplaying this. A lot of people I know are saying that it's a witch hunt for the Super League. It's like retribution for the Super League, but that's, you know, the Italian government, the Guardia di Finanza does not take orders from UEFA. Like this is like as if the SEC went to the Dallas Cowboys and said, you're doing financial weirdness. And also it goes back a long way. It goes back, you know, I'll open up the can of worms. Like I said, before we started recording, it goes back to when Cristiano Ronaldo signed. 2018 is when they started looking at these. 2018 is when we signed Cristiano Ronaldo and started this massive financial outlay that needed things shifted around. I mean, you remember when Juventus first signed Ronaldo and the absolute panic that they had in trying to offload Gonzalo Higuain's salary that year once he was gone. You know, Juve, that move was, you know, I had always said that move had us stretched to the absolute max, and then the pandemic knocked it over. Now, at the same time, like you said, it's not just Juventus. In fact, Juventus have the most, in terms of quantity of moves, Juventus are the most, are the biggest name on this list. The single largest transfer on the list, though, belongs to Napoli. That's Victor Osimhen, who was apparently, that deal involved like four different players, none of whom actually played for Lille after that. They were all offloaded really fast. So at the same time, all of the people are like, oh, Juventus is cheating again, rah, rah. No, that's not it. You know, this is not just Juve. This is Napoli. This is They're also looking, Corriere dello Sport said today, they're looking at Napoli, Roma, Atalanta, Genoa, and Sampdoria as the targets of this all. This is a significant chunk of the league that they're looking at. It's not just us, but it could have major ramifications. You know, it could be as simple as the club getting fined, which, you know, okay, not great considering what the team's finances are right now, but fine. Could get docked points, which may or may not matter by the end of the season. But one way or the other, if something comes out of this investigation, that has to be the last straw for Andrea Agnelli, right? Like, that has to be the point where either he has to suck it up and resign, or John Elkann just has to look at him and say, cuz, you're done. Right? Or am I just like, or is that just wishful thinking, do you think?
I mean, it could be wishful thinking, but we've seen Agnelli describe him as hit after hit or whatever. But, you know, whether it's the Sarri disaster, or, you know, the 1 year with Sarri that obviously ended poorly, the Pirlo experiment that I guess my view on it has changed a little bit after actually, you know, watching Pirlo work in the Amazon dock. And then obviously Allegri's start has not started well. And then you put the Super League on top of it as the cherry on top of the sundae. And the Ronaldo signing not working out well in terms of results on the field. So it's been a lot, but I don't know. You know, obviously Agnelli is the president. He carries a lot of weight both in the family and the club itself. So I've thought about that too. It's just, what would it actually take for Andrea Agnelli to not just resign, but, you know, do the patented, you know, kind of like Allegri the first time around, the mutual parting of ways? I don't know.
Yeah, probably nothing. When your family owns the whole damn thing, you know, you probably get a pretty long leash. I would venture a guess.
Yes, the family owns it, but I mean, don't quote me on this because I'm not an expert on the Italian social scene, but if my memory serves me right, I've heard people say that John Elkann and Andrea Agnelli do not have the greatest of relationships with each other. And John is the one that runs everything.
Yeah, maybe.
So, maybe. Like, he's the ultimate. He has the ultimate say.
Who knows? I guess this is, I stand firmly in a middle ground when it comes to this thing in the real world. I'm a business major, so this kind of somehow really interests me because it's something that I've always thought. It's like, what's a player really worth? Right? Like, it's not like a commodity. It's not like an iPhone that, you know what the worth is. It's set by the market. If someone wants to sell you an iPhone for $50,000, you'd be like, no, because I know that it's worth this amount of dollars. But for a player, really a player is worth whatever it is that a club is willing to pay for, right? Like, there's no set thing. Like, if suddenly tomorrow Real Madrid decides that I'm worth 15 million euros, who's to say that I'm not that worth that? You know, like, it's really something very, it's a gray area. And I have here the guy who's reporting this for the New York Times is Tariq Pandya, who I'm sure I butchered his name, so I'm sorry. But he's saying that 62 transfers are being investigated, 42 of them in both Juventus, including the Joao Cancelo Danilo swap and the Pjanic and Arthur swap. But the one that apparently is the most egregious is, like Sam was saying, the Victor Osimhen deal, which saw four players of, according to him, little pedigree go to Lille for 20 million euros, apparently. Only one of them has appeared in a match, who is a backup goalkeeper. The other three are all back in Italy. Two currently play in the lowest ranks of Italian soccer. One now plays semi-professionally. And for Juventus, the transfers that are being investigated are the 8 million, you know, the plusvalenza of 8 million between Marley Ake from Marseille and Franco Tonja. Another 8 million swap with Barcelona between Marques Mendes and Mateus Pereira. And the Nicolò Rovella, which is probably the one that's most, you know, relevant to Juventus right now, in which we sent over Manolo Portanova and Alia Petterelli for a combined 18 million euros. Between both of those dudes, they have played 144 minutes of top flight professional football. So, it's clearly that there's something fishy going on. But again, I don't think that legally speaking or financially speaking, there it's going to come out, anything's going to come out, because yeah, who's to say if Genoa believes that Manolo Portanova is such a dazzling young talent that he's worth 10 million euros, even though he's played not even two full games in Serie A. You know, it's tough to prove otherwise. Do I think it's kind of like a shady practice? Absolutely it is, but it's tough. I just can't see, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but it's tough for me to see how they mount a case, not only against Juventus, but against all the teams involved in this, because it's, you know, like I said, if someone believes that's what a guy's worth, how do you disprove that? How do you prove that he's not worth that in a legal sense, I guess? Obviously, you can say, hey, he's played, you know, 100 minutes of Serie A. He's obviously not worth 10 million euros, but, you know, there's not a rule book. There's not a thing set in stone of what's a thing supposed to worth. So you know, it's going to be very interesting just from a precedent standpoint. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how they pursue this case and how the case gets resolved, because this whole swap thing, it's been going on the last couple of years. It's a relatively new thing. But from the moment we started seeing it, I remember in this podcast, I remember writing about it on the blog, about how sketchy and shady the whole thing was, and about how everyone was saying, oh, this is glorified, you know, book cooking, which it is.
Didn't you call it financial doping at one point, Sergio?
Because it is. It absolutely is. Like, it's obviously what it is, but to prove it from a legal standpoint, I think it's going to be really, really tricky to do. So I don't see Juventus, you know, getting anything more than maybe a slap in the wrist. But just from a reputational standpoint, it's probably not great to be investigated by the Italian authorities. You know, going back to the initial point, do I think this reflects badly on Agnelli? Absolutely. Do I think this is the final nail in his coffin? Probably not. I would actually bet if Juventus does not make the Champions League, I would put much more weight into that being like the, you know, a big reason if he resigned or if he was relieved of his duties or however you want to call it. I would put that as a bigger weight than wherever this investigation ends up going, because like I said, they're not the only club involved. They're not even the most egregious ones that are involved. And it's going to be something tough to fight. It's something tough to prove, I guess, and, you know, in a legal sense. But yeah, it's definitely interesting. It's definitely great when you lose two huge games, won by a blowout, and then the government is investigating your organization. It's a great point to be a Juventus fan. It really is. Like, we're really living in a golden era of Juventus football.
When you were talking, Sergio, I looked up a couple of not swap deals, but just general deals that made me laugh, kind of, you know, the outrageous valuations of players. And the most notable one for me, obvious, and it might be for other people as well, is the Stefano Storaro deal with Genoa, where Juventus sold him back to Genoa not so long after buying him. And, you know, obviously we poke fun at Storaro because it's easy to, but he's not the greatest footballer in the world by any means necessary. And Juventus sold him back to Genoa after buying him for 5.5 million euros. They sold him back to Genoa for 16.5 million and made a positive economic, you know, a capital gain of 13 million euros. So, you know, as much as the swap deals are very much under the microscope right now, just the value, like you said, the valuations are just, you know, for the last few years have just kind of gone absolutely haywire. And it's totally crazy to think about kind of how now in retrospect, like they sold this guy for how much, you know, they bought this guy for how much they made this kind of money off a move that really didn't seem all that nondescript at all. So yeah, it's
really funny. I wrote about it in the graph back, but the Portanova deal, I was looking at their stats and Transfermarkt, which, you know, Grant is not the, you know, it's not the law by any means, but Transfermarkt values both players combined at 1.25 million euros.
Exactly.
Which to me is, it. Look, I don't know if they're right, but it seems like a lot more, like a lot closer to reality than 18 million euros for two guys who haven't really even seen the field with Genoa. I was looking, Portanova has two appearances, and the other guy, who I already forgot his name, Pettarelli, he's on loan in Serie B. So it's like, what are we talking about here? It's also, obviously just made up numbers.
Remember Andrea Favilli?
Yeah, I do.
Who went for like almost eight to, I think, Genoa?
Yeah, was that one summer. It was Favilli. It was what the big old lug of a striker they bought from, or they signed on a free from Parma after Parma went bankrupt. Alberto Cerri, and a couple other youngsters. And it's just like, how are we getting these figures? These guys have barely played on the senior level at all.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's great. And like I said, if I'm Genoa and I have a bunch of lawyers asking me about those deals, it's like, hey, we believe a whole heck of a lot in Manolo Portanova. We believe that dude's going to be a start, and we got a freaking bargain at 10 million euros before he becomes the next Messi and he's worth like 100 million. And if he doesn't, well, oops, we're a bad team. We did a poor job scouting him. Like, is that a crime? Like, is it a crime that we're incompetent? Probably not. So, I mean, it's hard to prove how they make that a crime. And it's great because in the statement for Juventus, they said that they're cooperating with investigations and they are in line with the international practice in the football industry. So it's like they know that everyone does this and they know that it's like a common practice and that it's going to be tough that they prove it legally that they're like, it's, I don't even know if it's a crime. It's probably a crime, but how do you prove it? And just in general, I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see how the whole thing unfolds. It really is. I think it's going to set a big precedent on how transfers, you know, are dealt with moving forward. Not just for Juventus, not just in Italy, but in general for the whole world.
It makes me wonder if Italy is looking into this in particular because, I mean, look at how many clubs Italy has lost in the last 10, 15 years. Every year there's a roll call of bankruptcies in Serie B and Serie C. Like that, like, you know, we just lost Chievo Verona this year. Siena went up, Parma went up. There are a lot of teams, some of which have at least name pedigree, you know, in terms of just having been around for a really long time, that have been, you know, I remember I was at Bleacher Report when Parma died, and I wrote a couple of different articles about how that team went bankrupt, and just the out and out criminality that went on while that team was going bankrupt in 2014 to 15, and you know, yeah, you have the Phoenixes and the Phoenix clubs and everything, but that. I think that one of the reasons that this is happening in Italy specifically is just how much this kind of book cooking covers up serious financial problems until it's too late. And then a club goes bankrupt. Reading at one place when Parma went under that they had something like 46 or 47 different players out on loan in different places. I think I remember reading a player walked in. He said, I'm under contract. I'm a Parma player. And they're like, okay, yeah, just sit over there until we figure out something to do with you. Like it was like, they couldn't keep track of all that stuff. I do feel like there's an eye in this towards preventing that and preventing this real, real eyesore in terms of Italian soccer, of just losing club after club after club because there is no financial stability.
And I think that's a super, you know, interesting and fascinating point because, you know, let's say Juventus, you know, they get caught in this and whatever. It's at the end of the day, they actually do have valuable assets. They do have good players that they could, in case everything goes bad, that they could sell and actually get profit. And even if that goes wrong, they have, you know, they're part of X, or worst comes to worst.
Yeah, they have business daddy.
Yeah, they inject a bunch of money and that's that. But Genoa, you know, if Genoa, sure, they can put Manolo Portanova as an asset for 10 million in their books. But if it does not pan out, which he probably won't, you know, you start, I mean, you have to, like any other asset, you have to start devaluing it. And you had a 10 million euro assets that ends up becoming nothing or worth nothing, where do you go from there? How many of those assets that you just end up writing off for nothing can you sustain until, like Sam's saying, until that actually becomes an issue for you as a club? And that, to me, I think is the biggest problem. The smaller clubs that are, you know, being okay with this type of dealings, sure, I'm guessing maybe in the short term it helps them, but you do enough of these deals for, you know, phony players that are not worth what you're putting in your books that they are actually worth, and I don't know how long you can sustain this. So I think it's definitely a thing that, like, it usually is. I think it's going to end up screwing over smaller clubs rather than the big clubs that they're not right now. They're the focus, obviously, because they're the brand names and people are going to focus on them. But it, really, the biggest impact is going to be felt on those smaller clubs that are doing the same thing, but they don't have the financial safeguards to, you know, to hold on and to keep being a club if things go south. And they will go south, because at the end of the day, there's only so many times that you can say a guy is worth a lot more than he actually is until you end up, you know, paying the consequences. So, like I said, I mean, this is just something that's super fascinating to me. And would I wish that Juventus was not involved? Absolutely. But, you know, it is what it is. And I think it's just going to be really, really interesting to see how the whole thing gets sorted out.
And I know kind of this current world is, you know, a lot of the lexicon has become about, like, the COVID variants. I feel like this is kind of like a variant out of co-ownership going by the wayside.
Mm.
And now, obviously, this is kind of like the morphed economic part of it. And to kind of put a bow on it before we wrap things up, I mean, how, and it's not a, obviously it wasn't a swap deal, but how much of this summer's transfer rumors was about Juventus want to sell Ronaldo for this certain amount of money just so that they wouldn't post a loss on the books? I mean, that's essentially what a lot of the market now is really.
And why the Christian Romero deal was criticized so hard was because it was a loss.
Yeah, it was a loss. And then you see, and then obviously you had added insult to injury where Atalanta spent him off to Tottenham for 50 something million. So yeah, I mean, that's what the market these days is so much about, the books on top of the player. And I mean, obviously that's always been the case, you know, money comes in, money comes out. But now, since as Sam and we've mentioned before, the current economic state of both Juventus and just the sport in general, because of the pandemic and empty stadiums for a year and a half, so much of the concentration is really on, you know, how can we make a positive impact on our bottom line just because we're struggling so much financially. And hopefully something comes out of this, because if it doesn't, then it'll just continue. And we'll continue to see Juventus youth players who never step foot at the Allianz Stadium being spun off for, you know, who knows how much. So on that note, we are done for the day. Thank you all for listening. As always, like I said before, Twitter questions will make their return next week, and so will Chuck's, hopefully. So as always, you can listen to us on your favorite podcasting platform, whether it is Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. If you are a listener on Apple Podcasts, feel free to rate us a review, give us a nice rating, all of that good stuff. So for Sam Lopresti, for Sergio, and for Chuck's, who is out of mind but not out of life, I guess.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that.
I don't know. I'm trying to make a joke of what you said earlier. So for everybody here, this is Danny saying thank you very much for listening, and we'll hopefully be in a better mood next week.